This podcast is from the IDPF Digital Book 2012 Conference at Book Expo America.
I'd like to introduce Peter Myers, who is an author and a consultant, and his current project is a book called Breaking the Page, about the transition from digital, from print to digital. And so without further ado, here's Peter.
Thanks a lot, Garth. You know, it's really tempting, I would say, to tackle the topic of how to design content for an infinite canvas, for these boundless pages, to start from the perspective of what these devices can do, what the iPad can do, what you can do on the Kindle Fire, what you can do on the web. But today, for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to take a sort of slightly counterintuitive perspective and talk instead, rather than about everything that the devices let you do, instead, I'm going to talk about the ways in which these touchscreen devices are actually less reader-friendly than print books. I'm going to talk about the ways that they get in the way of the reading experience, and they diminish the connection that readers have to the content and the kind of sacred communion that you expect between reader and author when you settle into a book. Let me show you a quick example of what I'm talking about, and then I'll go into some more particulars. But this is a print book, as you probably remember still. It's a great book that just came out this year called Children's Picture Books. Can you hear me back there? Great. I think a fairly common way of interacting with a print book, particularly a reference book like this, for the first time, is to, you know, to do this kind of thing where you sort of go through the book, you flip the pages, your eye is catching a lot of the editorial elements that an author and an interior page designer have spent time thinking about. Things like headers and chapter titles and captions and illustrations. And it's amazing if you think about it, the amount of information you can review simply by going through a book like this and make some really interesting decisions about what parts of the book you want to take a look at. Maybe you stick a sticky note, you know, at a certain spot. Maybe you just put your thumb in the text. But as you go through it, roughly at a rate like this, you really can glean quite a bit about what is available. Now, let me contrast that with a similar experience. And I'm going to switch back and forth quite a bit between the iPad and the slides. Contrast that with a book app that I really love. I really love this. It's called History of Jazz, and it's a history of jazz throughout the 20th century. It's organized as a timeline that you swipe sort of left to right on to go through the content. But let me show you the way that most people use an app like this for the first time. And I show this app quite a bit, so I have a pretty good sense of how the reader comes to an app like this the first time they open it up. And this is more or less what they do, right? Because you can swipe back and forth. You probably see there we go. I won't pick it up, but you know what I'm doing here. I'm going back and forth. And here's the problem. I think you probably can get it right away. The content is moving too fast for your brain and your eye to process. And what speed do you really need to be moving that content, to be moving your finger to make sense of the of what's in the book? Roughly like this. This is about the speed at which the eye and the brain can process the choices that that are available and what's in here. How many people actually use the app at that speed? Zero. You cannot resist the temptation, particularly if you're somebody who hasn't been using a touchscreen device for 5 years, as all of us in the room probably have been. You can't resist the temptation to move the content at this speed. So the device itself encourages people to interact with the content at a rate that exceeds people's ability to make sense of it. And so the problem here in this example is that, you know, what we're essentially looking at is content that is, even though it's on this kind of infinite canvas, it's really print content. It's a massively long scroll that has been put in front of the finite viewport of the iPad, and it hasn't been repurposed. So the problems really are introduced. Come back, please. the problems are introduced by the device, by the capabilities of the device, and the content hasn't been rethought for the infinite screen in a way that really makes it friendly to browsers, to human browsers. So that's really what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to go through five different problems that these touchscreen infinite canvas devices introduce, that the five different things that these devices sort of impose on the reading experience, and take a look at some ways that things can go wrong, and also a few examples, not all necessarily from book publishing, to sort of get around the limitations of the device. You know, just to quickly sort of give you a quick tour of what lies ahead, you know, how big is it? Judging the size of the content in a book is a key part of the reading experience, and it's something that, you know, the print books really make easy to do because of some of the tangible physical properties of them that aren't available on a digital display. Making comparisons is something that we also all do all the time, whether consciously or unconsciously as readers. And again, in print, there are very specific ways that a print book lets people do that. The small screen size of even a relatively large device like the iPad imposes limitations that we don't have in most print books with the two-page spread. The attention distractions that come with these touchscreen devices are considerable sort of change in the dynamic between content and reader, and those need to be thought through really carefully. And then finally, the act of browsing and discovery, which I sort of touched on a little bit in that opening example. It's something we have all sorts of ways to deal with in print, but when we get into these digital devices, and if we don't rethink the way we're laying out the content and making it browsing friendly, we end up imposing problems that we probably don't expect, and the end result is that the books don't deliver, these virtual digital books don't deliver as intensive and immersive a reading experience as we're used to in print. So let me start with the first category, and that's how big is it? You know, making a sort of judgment about the size of the book in front of us. And to start with, I guess I'll just talk a little bit briefly about, you know, why is that important? Why is it important to know the size of the book? Where does that factor into the way that we interact with books? And a couple things come into play. First, a sense of progress. And following on a sense of progress is a sense of completion and accomplishment. This is a key part of the reading experience, and this is a key reason that people come to books as, in a way, a source of refuge in not only an age of information overload, but also at a time when we're inundated and besieged by micro bits of content, you know, Twitter and status updates and Facebook and text and all that. So the very purpose of a book is, I think, to provide readers with a sustained engagement with a text, with a story, with an author. And one of the ways that we, you know, we sort of get a sense of our progress through a book, well, in print, it's pretty simple, right? We have the physical, you know, the foredge, the page stack, and we know that, you know, here is what we've read and here is what remains. But when we start dealing with these digital displays, which have no physical properties, we start losing the ability to easily and quickly convey a sense of how much has been read. So we need to kind of really start thinking through carefully about how to replicate in ways that are appropriate for these devices. So not, please, these virtual, you know, representations of the page stack, because that really, we lose all sorts of things when we try to do these, you know, so-called skeuomorphic representations of the print book. So one of the things that I want to start with is an example. is an example from an app that is not a book app. It's a music discovery and listening app, of course. Let me do that real quick here again. Sorry. BEABW. All right. So it's a music discovery app that lets you explore independent bands. And the interesting thing about it's called Auditorium. It's a beautiful app. And one of the interesting things about this app is how literally on its home screen, it does use an essentially infinite canvas. Each one of the grids that you're looking at here, each one of the tiles is art that is, it's basically album art for each band. And as you can see, when you tap on an individual tile, as I will in a second, you get music from the band and then lyrics and videos and things like that. But as you know, you pan across here, you're really looking at content that spans far north, south, east, and west of the visible display. So the challenge that they face here is how do you give the user a sense of how much that they have taken a look at? And the way that they do that is they leave the tiles illuminated for the bands that people have explored. So here, I'll tap here. I didn't connect this to audio, but you start listening to the band and you get some lyrics and you get the chance to listen to videos. But look what happens. That tile then remains illuminated. And I'll come here, listen to another band for a second. And the same thing happens there. So while this app doesn't give a complete sense of the totality of the volume of all the bands that are available, it does leave these kind of visible breadcrumbs so that you get a sense as a user for how much progress you've made through the app. In a different example that is from the book app world. This is Glow Bible. It's a really great Bible reading app, a Bible reading environment that's available on the iPad and on the web and PC and Mac based as well. And the interesting thing that they do here is they build in reading plans to this app. Not just simply reading the Bible from beginning to end, but also they carve out these niche subtopic reading plans, so you can read just about grief or faith or top verses to memorize, and you set up a reading plan that helps you bite off a little bit each day. So, for example, if you're reading the full Bible, you click on that Start Today's Reading. It brings you to the main text itself, and you go through. And as you complete each passage, you just click this little next button, and it keeps track of what you're doing. So here, the app is giving the user a way both in percentage terms, but also in terms of a schedule to sort of not only measure their progress, but also to motivate them in the same way that you might if you were a marathon runner and there are mile markers showing up. That gives the reader a sense of progress, which is really, again, I think a key part of how we interact with books. Now, we'll say, finally, on this topic or category of judging the overall size of a book, there's a lot of work ahead, and I think a lot of opportunities in terms of solving that problem of how to convey the total amount of content in a book app. And I think some of the most promising solutions right now are being done in the so-called field of information visualization, where people are taking, in a lot of cases, scientists are looking at ways to visualize large data sets. And I think if you know, if you're involved in this world of designing these digital book apps, if you spend time thinking about and exploring the ways in which information visualization has taken large quantities of data and made things like tree maps and heat maps and knowledge maps, they really provide a kind of interesting set of examples for how, in a pageless environment, we could start conveying to readers the sort of sum total of all the content that's available. So the next thing, the next category that I wanted to talk about is making comparisons. And this is another kind of component of the reading experience that the average reader of a print book might not be thinking about. Sir, would you mind just tapping the fourth button down from the top? If you just hold it and tap it, then those lights will go back down. That'd be great. Thanks. So, you know, making comparisons is a big part of what we do as readers, whether we think about this consciously or not. One thing that we do when reading a fiction book is the act of memory. We encounter a character in the early pages of a novel, and then later on, as the book progresses, we meet that character again, and we use our memory to sort of think about how the characterization has played out. So we may physically be flipping back to early pages in the book to jog our memory, or we may just be doing it as a sort of mental exercise to build an understanding of the various characters that, you know, populate a book. But this dynamic is also at play in nonfiction, in reference works, where a reader might be assembling a kind of mental collection of interesting or relevant content nuggets, and whether they're jotting those things down having to do with American history or the history of children's picture books or bicycles, whether they're jotting them down or keeping them in memory, what you're doing as a reader is accumulating the interesting parts of the book and then making your own sense of what a book is telling you. And here you are sort of making comparisons in a way that in print, at least we have some mechanisms to do this, be it, again, just plain old memory or sticky notes or a piece of paper. But when we start using these virtual digital book apps, our ability to, because of things like the small screen, to just flat out put two or more items up on the screen and sort of see how they compare and contrast is really compromised. At this point, really the best thing that we have is in some of the leading ebook reading apps like the Kindle app. But even that is a really watered down version of the act of either putting a bookmark in the book or dog-earing the page or a sticky note, because of the way that we as readers construct a kind of mental model of the book as we read a print book. So I'm going to show you a couple of examples of some interesting tools that are either being used or could be used. And again, I'm going to start with Glow, which I'll come to a couple times because they really do some interesting things. And the feature that they have here, they call Sessions. And all it is really is Windows on the iPad, and it allows the reader to launch multiple versions of the same book. And this is incredibly powerful because what it does is lets you start reading a passage here in this window/sessions. And then if you're thinking, well, how does that compare to a later book in the New Testament? Or how does that compare to some artwork which is included with the app? You just tap on the Sessions buttons, you scroll through the windows, all of the content is available, and then you can quickly make your way back to the point at which you were reading. It's a subtle tool, but if you think about it, it's much more powerful having the ability to launch these virtual copies of the same book than it is to use the sort of dinky notes and highlights, you know, sort of scrolling window in an app like the Nook or the Kindle. The other thing that I wanted to show in this realm, again, this is an example that doesn't come from the world of book publishing. It's an app called Moodboard. And the reason I wanted to share it here, it's a app meant for designers and scrapbookers and visual thinkers. Makes it very easy to go out on the web, grab a clip of a web page, put it here, add some arrows, add some text, and move all these things around. The interesting thing that I think this app shows, just as an example, as a kind of a thought design experiment, is the ways in which if you give the reader a flexible virtual corkboard that they can pull things onto, they can start personalizing their reaction to what they're reading in a way that, again, I don't think the Notes and Highlights tool makes possible. If you can hit the, sir, would you mind hitting the fourth button down? The fourth button down? That'd be great. Yeah, if you just tap it, that'd be great. So I think you get a really, you get a great idea of what the benefits of a really rich canvas like this could provide. The way I think of that tool, again, to use the Kindle app as an example, is the notes and highlighting pane, which you're probably all familiar with, which is where you, you know, you make virtual bookmarks and you make your notes. That's Amazon space. That's their territory that they have carved out. I mean, I'm not saying they're being chintzy or anything, but it's their space. This thing here is my space. This is where I can personalize my reaction to a book. Again, this is not a book app, but it gives you an idea of how powerful a reader's connection between his reaction and the text can be when you give them a canvas on which they can compose. The next thing... That's called Moodboard. Moodboard. The next thing I wanted to talk about is small screens. And this is the challenge of even, again, on an iPad, which we think of today as a relatively larger display than, say, a smartphone. You know, even on an iPad, we're dealing with considerably less real estate that we get in a print book, especially, you know, a book of this size opened and giving the reader the full two-page spread. Now, again, why is that important? What's the advantage of having the, you know, the larger real estate? And there's a couple things that come into play. First, when an author wants to cover something that I think I'd kind of broadly describe as a system, be it the passage of events over the course of a century, the sequence of events in a crime scene, when they have the available space to lay out in a bird's eye view kind of way all of those events, there's a really powerful difference and a really powerful learning dynamic that's happening there when the reader is able to see all of that material on one static screen. Contrast that, for example, with, let's say, five sequences, you know, say some crime happens and five things happen, you know, with the bank robber approaching the bank and then leaving. You know, the typical approach in a digital book is to lay it out on five screens. The problem is the memory burden that you're imposing on the reader, because they have to remember what's happened on that first screen as they make their way through screens 2, 3, 4, and 5. So huge advantages of the real estate that you get in a print book. And the general tendency in designing these digital books is either to chunk things up into one screen after another or succumb to what I think is kind of a mistake, which is to think, well, if I just let the reader pan, then that's the equivalent of a large spread. But it's not, because as soon as you're letting a reader or asking a reader to pan across content, you're essentially really just taking a really big page and asking them to chunk it up and use memory that they might not necessarily have. So let me share a couple of examples of some really innovative innovative ways that I think designers have sort of thought through and thought around that challenge in ways that are very specific to devices like this. This is my last example for Glow Bible, and I'm not on their payroll, but I love a lot of what they do, so it makes it easy to sort of feature them. So this is what's coming up here is a bird's eye view. Ah, thank you. A bird's eye view of the Bible, of the Old Testament and the New Testament. the standard issue approach, I would say, to material like this, be it text or images, is what I call dumb zooming. You use the pinch or the spread gesture to go in, or use the double tap gesture, and you just simply give the viewer more pixels. But what they, what Glow does here, and which I'll show in a second, is what Microsoft calls and others have called semantic zooming. As the user zooms in, you deliver them more information. So let's say, first, now I've gotten a nice bird's eye view of all the books in the Bible. Let's say I want a little bit more about Genesis. So as I go in here, and I can tap again, look what happens there. I've gone in from the overall view of all of the totality of the Bible to Genesis. I get all the chapters in Genesis, and now I get some new running headers that give me additional information about grouped and themed content, like, for example, the first four chapters having to do with God's creation. Tap in again to the page level, and I see the actual material that I can start reading. But really, and they also provide a nice kind of round trip functionality. So as a reader, I can go through and engage in that process of going from a bird's eye view, zooming into the content, and then going back up. And that's a really powerful way for giving the reader the ability to make sense of these kind of large interconnected systems. That can't be done. This is not a print replica. This is a designer who has rethought their content for a digital display. The other example in this sort of realm that I wanted to share is a history app called World War II. This one is laid out on a timeline, much like the History of Jazz app that I showed in the beginning. So it does suffer from all the same problems when the user spans too quickly. It's all the key events that happened between 1939 and 1945. But they do something really interesting here. They give the user in the upper left-hand corner the ability to zoom out. So as I'm zooming out, at the highest magnification level, what the app is doing is moving to the forefront the 10 most important events in World War II. So it's shrunk in the entire timeline. So all I'm seeing on this screen, which is not pannable in any way, are the 10 most important events, and I can get at some of that content that's been shuffled into the background by tapping on it. Then if I want the more, you know, a closer view, I zoom in. But that's really interesting that they're giving the user control and giving the user the ability to move in and out and then automatically reshuffle the content. Now, I will point out one other problem here. What we're looking at on this screen are the 10 most important events between 1939 and 1945. And if you look at number 7, I'm not sure if you can see it back there, April 30th, 1945, 43, the British release a corpse dressed as an officer and carrying false documents into the Mediterranean. Probably not one of the top 10 most important events in World War II. The problem there being the need for the subject matter experts to work hand in hand with the designers and the developers when these kinds of decisions are being made. But that's a minor quibble. I really think this is very beautiful and innovative work in terms of thinking about how to give people a view of a large collection of content on a relatively small screen. This is called World War II. So maybe they also need some work on branding. Let me do them justice. I should say, let me make sure that I it's called Timeline World War II. I'm sorry?
What's the religious
one? The religious one is called Glow Bible. The final example that I want to sort of look at in this small screen category comes from Marvel. And it's a comic series that they've recently released in the past couple of months called Infinite Comics. And they're doing some incredibly innovative design work here in terms of thinking about how to make the transition from print to digital in a way that doesn't simply take the print page and put it on the touch screen. And they're also doing some really innovative things in terms of conveying things like change in perspective and action events unfolding on a smaller screen. Because keep in mind, the screen, even on the iPad, is smaller than the print space available in a print content, in a print comic. So what we're looking at here is a issue of Avengers versus X-Men. And I've queued up about halfway through this comic. And there's a guy, a character named Nova, who's just run into an explosion. So here we're seeing, at this point, him encountering the explosion. And the only gestures that I'm going to do that you can't see are page, you know, to page forward, it's tapping on the right. To page back, I tap on the left. So he runs into this explosion. The screen goes dark, conveys that he's lost consciousness. I tap again to move to the next frame. And look what happens here. They're using a blurred screen to convey the fact that he's regaining consciousness. Now the screen remains the same as I tap again, as I will do right now. And slowly he's starting to regain consciousness. So they're using a change in focus to convey the changing state of his coming back to life. The words have changed a little bit. He's on the left side of the screen. The dual pane conveys what he's looking up at as he's, if you can kind of make it out, and if you're a comics fan, who he's seeing on the right side is Captain America. I tap again. He comes in, both panes come a little bit more closely into focus. And that, again, conveys that Nova is making his way back into sort of full, you know, consciousness. Now watch what happens. We have two panes conveying different perspectives. The left pane disappears, and we have the full view that Nova is seeing from his vantage point on the ground of Captain America and all the people who are standing next to him waiting to help out Nova. I tap again. Nova shifts into this mode where he gets a sort of readout on all the people that he's seeing. Again, we're all on the same screen. Isn't this a brilliant use of a limited amount of space? And then finally, I'll go to the last screen in this episode. We pull back as though with a virtual camera on a wide-angle view of Nova down on the ground and the characters in the background, Captain America and all the people coming to help him. Brilliant, I think, way of conceding that there's less real estate available for the designer and rethinking how to use some of the properties of these touchscreen devices that really can't be done in print. Okay. The next problem, the fourth of five, is what I think of as the biggest challenge for designers today. And it is the distractions that users/readers face. You know, I mean, to state the obvious, when you're reading a book, if the content is compelling, the device itself doesn't offer any alternatives for entertainment or email checking or Twitter. The device is a refuge because it is the complete environment for delivering and conducting a kind of communion between author and reader. Of course, that's completely different on these touchscreen devices. Their device itself is loaded with dozens, if not hundreds, of alternatives that are a button away, and then, of course, the wider internet itself. So you have to, I think, be conscious of the fact that the canvas on which you're composing and designing your content is loaded with all of these lures. And again, I think if you think about one of the big reasons that people come to books in the first place, especially as they're being overloaded with micro messages and micro content like Twitter and Facebook, is for a kind of sustained communion with a message and with an author. So I think that then makes it incumbent on publishers and designers and authors to be even more careful with how they compose their content to minimize the temptations to hit that main button on the top of the iPad or any other device and move to one of the, you know, the many alternatives. So I want to start with an example of where this is a little bit challenging and where I don't think they quite pulled it off. And it comes from iBooks. And this is a book that was this was a book that was composed using Apple's new iBooks Author. And I think it's a great example to start with because, you know, iBooks Author, much like the sort of points I made in the beginning about how it's tempting to add content to these devices because the devices make it capable, you know, because an iPad is capable of displaying video and audio and interactivity, iBooks Author is sort of the software equivalent. It comes built in with the ability to sort of load in all this extra stuff. And if you don't wield that power carefully, I think you can end up presenting your reader with material that makes them more susceptible to the temptations that their device has, you know, one click away. So this is a beginning of it. This is a science textbook, and this is the beginning of a section about cells. We get a standard section introduction. You read the section introduction, and then you swipe. And this is the second page that the user faces, the user sees in this section. Look at what they're taking a look at here. An interactive graphic, a pull quote, a video, a caption to the video, headers on all that stuff, and a little bit of text up on the upper right side of the page. The problem here is the reading path is not clear. You're losing the attention of the reader by not composing a reading path that guides the reader through and around and over the course that you want to have them follow, which is not to say, of course, there can't be multiple points of entry on a particular screen. But when you put a display like this, a page layout like this in front of a reader, I would argue you're imposing a burden of choice on them that either consciously or unconsciously they don't want. They've come to your book for guidance. They've come to the book to be led through the author's story, be it fiction or nonfiction. And this gives them far too many choices and imposes far too much navigational, far too many navigational requirements on them. So let me, I'll contrast this with an example in a second, but I do want to show one other thing, and this is a problem that is created by no publisher, but is a feature I might call a bug of iBooks and iBooks Author itself. And it has to do with the page skimmer thingy. I think that's the technical term down on the bottom. And look what you can do with this. You can actually take any page and turn it, and then you can go like, you know, wee, like that. Now, of course, I lost my connection there. My point is, what value does that act and that gesture have as a content maneuver? How does that contribute in any significant way to the experience of learning about biology? I would argue that it not only doesn't contribute in any way, the mere temptation of that gesture degrades the audience's attention and connection to the text. So on the one hand, it falsely advertises some extra content or functionality, right? I mean, we're used to things like that right now that I kind of want this card to flip over and I want extra content to be available, but it doesn't. It does nothing. And the second thing that it does is that it puts me in mind of the fun of the iPad and the multi-touch gestures, and then it slowly worms its way into my brain that one click away is, you know, Plants versus Zombies, right? So this is, of course, nothing that you can control because this is a decision that Apple has made, but I just wanted to bring it up as an example of the dangers of introducing things like, I would call this kind of finger candy, into your content experiences. Now, to contrast this, I'm going to show you another publication written using iBooks Author. It's a self-published book, great book, by the way, called Paperless, by a guy named David Sparks about how to lead a paperless lifestyle and all the sort of things that you need to do to cut down on paper in your life. Look, for example, just very quickly at the way that he's laid out each page. He's using art. He's using sidebars, but what he's done is compose the page in the way that we as page designers from the print world know and recognize as a way to sort of guide the reader's eye through the content. The other thing that he's done, which I think is subtle but important, is on the right-hand side of this page, there's a screencast that shows the reader how to rename files. And there's a really nice and elegant handoff between the text and the screencast. The text, which I'm sure you can't read, finishes up by saying, screencast 4.1 shows how to rename a file on your Mac. That hands off the reader from the text to the screencast, where that activity is demonstrated in a way where video is much more powerful than words, and then the reader can pick up reading. I won't spend the time, but I guarantee you if you spend time with that other iBook textbook that I showed, you'll see all sorts of examples where it's not clear when you should stop reading the text and when you should go to the video, and that's really, really disruptive. The other example that I wanted to finish up with in this category comes from The New Yorker. And, you know, their challenge is to figure out a way to replicate the immersive experience of reading the print magazine, which so many people love, on the iPad. And they've gotten a lot of heat, especially in the tech world, for using Adobe's digital publishing suite and, you know, these hugely overbloated editions, which, by the way, from talking to folks at Condé Nast, I know is going to change. But in any case, they've been criticized for, in many ways, keeping to a sort of print-centric layout. But they really don't in some interesting ways. And the biggest one, and you can see it most clearly when I rotate, is look at the space that they've left on the left-hand margin. This is something that if you're a regular reader of the print edition of The New Yorker, you know is not there. So what the designers have done there is decided to leave some white space in the margin as a way, I think, of subtly conveying that there is a private zone, a sort of a clutter-free zone that you are entering as the reader. And it goes against, I think, the impulse that I see in so many other examples where designers think, I don't have a lot of space on this device, so I need to fill it up with as much information as I can. I think this is a really beautiful example of how less truly is more. And of how in certain contexts that are appropriate to certain kinds of content, leaving white space can help encourage a kind of focus among readers that we're much more used to in print. Okay. And then finally, I want to... come back to the place where I started, which is the activity of browsing and discovery. Now, in a conference like this, and if you spend any time in publishing circles, you hear a lot about discovery, and it's mainly mentioned in the context of helping consumers figure out where to buy their next book and how to make sense of the tens of thousands of new books that are being published each year. But I would suggest that there's an equally important and often overlooked act of discovery that's important to think about for people who've already purchased a book. For people who've purchased a book and want, either consciously or unconsciously, to return to the book over and over and to explore its contents and to discover new kinds of material inside the book. Particularly, this is the case with nonfiction. In a novel, you kind of either make it through from start to finish because you love the story. But when you get into the worlds of reference and how-to and recipes and cookbooks and travel guides and all that, these books are begging for design and content solutions that help elevate content and make it more friendly to discovery so that readers can keep coming back to their iPad and rediscovering. I mean, think about it, the Twitter app or the Mail app has got great discovery inducements built in because you get that nice badge and reminder that stuff is there. So I want to show, and I want to finish up with a couple of examples of how discovery might be designed and delivered in a way that isn't simply trying to sort of replicate the print-centric act of page flipping, which now I've kind of beat the dead horse of that doesn't work when you do it in print. So the first thing I wanted to show is an example called Art Circles. Again, this is not a book app. It's an app that has been recently released by a firm called Art.com. Come back. Ah, there we go. For selling art. So there's 1,000-plus different paintings and drawings in this app that the designers face the challenge of how do we help the person, how do we help the user browse through and discover new stuff on here? And they obviously want to give people a way and a reason to keep coming back to this app on a regular basis. And look at what they've done. I'm not sure if you can see it quite there in the back, but on the left-hand side of the screen, they're giving the user 4 really interesting ways to explore the content. On the top is this color wheel. Look what you can do here. You can pick which color you're interested in. You pick the color, you view the collection, and then you start browsing. Finally, I think this is a really great, tangible example of the benefits of well-structured, well-tagged, metadata content so that then you can rethink how to present in a real fun and reader-friendly way that's truly impossible in print. Some of the other wheels that they have are some curated tours of the content, words, so that you can like look at all the different art that's nostalgic or understated or ethereal. But this is a really addictive, I think, way of thinking about a large body of content and how to give people ways to sort of go through and explore the material in a way that can't be done in print and isn't trying to replicate print. And then the last example is a app which was released just late last week by a firm here in New York City called Semilinear, and their reading app is called Citia. It's a really remarkable product, I think. It's a way of reading a condensed version of a book, but I don't think that summary does it justice. This is the title that they've launched with is a Kevin Kelly book called What Technology Wants. And on one hand, what you're seeing here, like I said, is this summarized, condensed version that you can sort of browse through. But what they have done with the cooperation of HarperCollins and Kevin Kelly is identified themes in the book that aren't necessarily laid out in the print edition of the book. So they've identified some main themes. They've organized sort of subsets of content, which you as the reader then can tap into. And using this kind of fun to play with card presentation system, you can go through and read a summarized version in a nonlinear fashion. So you're getting a different version of the book than you do in print. One of the things that I think is really important here is that there's many thousands, maybe millions of readers out there who don't have 15 to 20 hours to give to Kevin Kelly for his new book, but maybe they have an hour. Or maybe they have 2 hours. Here's a version of his material, of his book, that lets you carve your own path through this material and read it with the time that you have available. And I think especially, again, in an age of information overload, more important than ever to carve out smaller sets. So that brings me to the end. 2 key principles to keep in mind. Think about what not to include when designing for infinite canvases. It's as important as thinking about what to include. And then perform a kind of QA on the reading experience. We in the publishing world have for decades been doing QA on formatting and appearance, and we put this off on production editors, and they perform a valuable service, and it creates a really polished and valuable print product. But we don't do that enough in these digital products that we create, and I think the QA that needs to be done in this realm has to address these somewhat subjective but equally important reading experience issues. I think we've probably run out of time for questions. If you're interested in more of this stuff, I write about it a lot on my blog. The book that I'm writing right now called Breaking the Page is really going to go into all this stuff in detail. There's a preview edition available right now, a draft of the first three chapters. The rest of the book will be ready later this year. Do we have time for any questions? We're probably
50 folks waiting to get in.
Okay. So thanks very much for your time.